Listener advisory. The following program contains adult themes and adult language, including a graphic account of the Steubenville rape case. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to New World Notes. This is Kenneth Doust. Today we'll take a cockeyed view of love and death. For love, we'll go to Steubenville, Ohio, with a great essay by Joanne Wypijowski. For death, we'll discuss the late former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan's equally evil twin. We'll hear how some victims of Thatcherism struck back with a song. And we'll hear a newly released satiric song, In Memoriam Margaret Thatcher, by Chumbawamba itself. So, the second half of the show has some graphic descriptions of sleazy sex, and the first half of the show shows very little respect for the recently departed. If you are seeking politeness, decorum, and good taste, this would be a great time to switch to another radio station. As for myself, I hope you'll stay tuned. We're talking about love and death, and we'll start off with death. And let's dedicate this part of the show to the great comedian Moms Mobley. In one of her routines, I think supposedly talking about her ex-husband, Moms said, "They say, don't say nothing about the dead unless it's good." All right, he's dead. Good. Margaret Thatcher died April 8. She was much loved by the world's ruling elite, whose cause she did much to advance. She was the United Kingdom's longest-serving prime minister, holding office from 1979 to 1990. Our own homegrown Ronald Reagan was president during 8 of those 11 years, and the two were intellectual soulmates, peas of the same pod. Both of them were right-wing ideologues who did much to destroy workers' rights, destroy labor unions, deregulate industry, deregulate finance, privatize what were formerly publicly owned functions, cut back government services to the common people, drive up corporate profits, drive down wages, drive up unemployment, and destroy job security. When the Brits finally tossed Thatcher's Conservative Party out of power, they found that the supposed opposition party they put in fact, pursued pretty much the same policies as the Thatcherites. The same thing happened here. The Democrat Clinton advanced all the same policies as his Republican predecessors Reagan and Bush 1, especially the destruction of welfare and the deregulation of the banks, not to mention NAFTA. Democrat Obama has better mastered the English language than either President Bush. That's the main difference I can see among them. Their goals, policies, and priorities are identical. So, Reagan and Thatcher are now both gone, but the policies they championed, like zombies, still stalk the earth. Here's a big difference between the Brits and us. When Mrs. Thatcher died this month, millions of Brits cheered and celebrated and toasted and uploaded videos to YouTube and wished the late Mrs. Thatcher a nice, warm eternity in the afterlife. That's very bad manners. But it is encouraging when working people can figure out who their enemies are. I wish we Yankees were that smart. Margaret Thatcher's death triggered a handful of noteworthy musical events. Here's one you may have missed. Remember that wonderful anarchist musical ensemble Chumbawamba? If my sources are correct, back in 2005, they recorded an extended play album called In Memoriam Margaret Thatcher. They have just now released it following her death. Chumbawamba no longer exists as a large ensemble, so this new composition is quite a treat. It's not every memorial cantata that contains phrases like, quote, your one-way ticket to hell, unquote, but this one does. In Memoriam, Margaret Thatcher is too long for the show, but we'll hear a couple parts of it. Here is one.
The ladies not fraternal.
Baroness Thatcher, who, as Margaret Thatcher, was Britain's first woman Prime Minister, has died.
Chumbawamba, recorded in 2005 and released the second week of April 2013. Did you hear that little hint of Ding Dong the Witch is Dead at the very beginning? That brings us to our next story. Another commemorative musical event got a little more publicity over here. Here's the story. When Thatcher died, the establishment British media predictably burst forth with fawning obituaries, praising to the skies the lady's great accomplishments. The glorious war on the Falkland Islands, for example, against that mighty and evil foe, Argentina, and so on. A lot of average blokes who were on the receiving end of Thatcher's slash-and-burn economic policies, or whose parents were, weren't buying the media's celebration of Thatcher. Someone started a campaign to get the song Ding Dong the Witch is Dead onto the UK's official music hit list for the week. Yes, straight from the 1939 movie The Wizard of Oz. All 51 seconds of song. Getting it onto the charts would get the song played on all the radio programs that featured the week's top 10 hits. The BBC itself had such a program. The recorded music happened to be available as a single on iTunes. Thousands of people paid money to download it. So many people bought the song that it rose to number 2 in the charts in the United Kingdom. Radio stations across Britain were playing a 75-year-old, 51-second song, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, right after the death of the former Prime Minister. But you may have heard on this show or elsewhere the occasional remark about the bias of the corporate-controlled media. Well, in case you had any doubts, get this. I did a Google search for the story, and I found that almost every newspaper in England ran the story with an almost identical headline. They all ran basically this headline: Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead fails to reach number one spot. Fails! Isn't that hilarious? Thatcher dies, and Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead suddenly is resurrected and becomes the number two hit in all the United Kingdom, including England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. So the corporate press announces the song's failure to reach number one. That's like, imagine in America, for the 2016 election, the citizens are so sick of having to choose between two corporate stooges running for president, so sick of it that there's a massive protest write-in campaign for Khloe Kardashian. And Khloe carries 22 states and falls just 5 electoral votes short of winning the presidency. And all the newspapers report this with the headline, America Rejects Kardashian. But back to the Prime Minister. Here's a postscript. Much as I hate to say anything good about Presbyterians, credit where due, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead did become the week's number one hit in Scotland. All right, way to go, guys. Margaret Thatcher devoted her career to serving the interests of the elites. When she retired, they rewarded her by making her officially a lifetime member of the aristocracy, with the title Baroness Thatcher of Kesteven in the county of Lincolnshire. But she was not to the manor born. Her family was petty bourgeois, lower middle class, we would say. Her father owned 2 grocery stores in Lincolnshire, and the whole family lived in an apartment over one of his stores. In the eyes of the upper crust, being a grocer is bad enough. Worse still, Maggie's father was not only a grocer, but a very active Methodist. Obviously, anyone with any pretension to breeding is Church of England, at least for Christmas weddings and funerals. I just mention this because in the next selection, Chumbawamba refers a couple of times to grocers and Methodists. You know the type. Well, the Brits ain't going to work on Maggie's farm no more, but Thatcherism, like Reaganism, never went away. Now Maggie's Conservative Party is back in power, and the Brits are working on David Cameron's farm, and life for the farm workers is worse than ever. Here's some more of Chumbawamba's In Memoriam Margaret Thatcher.
Oxford for chemistry, mend and make do. Society turned her the truest of blue. Back in the shop, Mr. Roberts had taught that people like flour can be sold and be bought. Masters above and servants below, waiting for Margaret to go. Masters above and servants below, waiting for Margaret to go. Oh, waiting for Margaret to go. Up to the house where the loyalty wears, thinner than carpets on father's old stairs. Her friends like her enemies stretched on the rack, play happy families, but don't turn your back. The grocers and Methodists lay her down low, waiting for Margaret to go. The grocers and Methodists lay her down low, waiting for Margaret to go home, waiting for Margaret to go. Alfred, he closes the shop one more time. Little girl singing her nursery rhymes. Here comes a candle to light you to bed. Here comes a chopper to chop off your head. Down with the shutters and on with the show. No more waiting for Margaret to go. Down with the shutters and on with the show. No more waiting for Margaret to go. No more waiting for Margaret to go.
Yes, I hope to go on and on.
Like all other bands.
What?
But I'm not counting anymore. So close your eyes and slip to darkness deep while we sing, sing you to sleep. Close your eyes, your darkest deeds to keep while we sing, sing you to sleep. While we sing, sing you to sleep.
Well, we've had a sardonic and impolite look at death. Let's move on to a sardonic and impolite look at love. And in recent weeks, the love capital of the United States was not Waikiki, or Las Vegas, or the Poconos, or even the men's locker room at Penn State. No, the love capital of the United States shifted to Steubenville, Ohio. Only temporarily, one hopes. In a sensational trial, two high school football heroes were convicted and imprisoned for having extremely intimate physical contact with a 16-year-old girl who may or may not have been conscious, but who certainly was very, very drunk. Nation columnist Joanne Wibijowski wrote a wonderful essay on the event, and she draws some interesting connections to the gay marriage cases now before the Supreme Court. Let's have a listen. This was published online in Counterpunch, April 12, 2013, and I have condensed it and slightly censored it for radio. It's titled Primitive Heterosexuality. Wibijowski writes, two sensational court hearings have dominated the news. The Supreme Court case on gay marriage and the rape trial of teenagers in Steubenville, Ohio. There are connections between the two. In Steubenville, a drunken 16-year-old girl was sexually exploited by a couple of high school football heroes while other teenagers watched, tweeted, took photos or videos, posted them on the net, but did nothing else. The two boys, also drunk and 16, were convicted in March and could be in prison until they are 21, then registered sex offenders for life. Meanwhile, marriage is painted in pastels by gay leaders and their straight allies. To be married is the best of all worlds. Key to stable families, successful children, robust society, they argue. And yet there's Steubenville, which is in fact Anytown, USA. Here the mostly straight offspring of those heterosexual sacred unions behave like animals. In reality, we still exist largely in a realm of primitive heterosexuality. Central to it is marriage, but before marriage there is courtship, and before courtship there is high school. Heterosexuality in high school is not pretty. Boozed-up parties and zonked-out kids are its rites of passage. Someone, usually a girl, has her head in a toilet. If she's lucky, a friend holds her hair while she vomits. Her friends attend to her just long enough to make sure she's not dying. Others jeer. Everyone is drunk and stupid and very young. They drink and dance, make out, grope one another, disappear into parked cars. Back inside, the casualties mount. Two drunken kids on a couch paw each other until the girl throws up. The boys all laugh. One boy is standing on a table, in only underpants and a tie, hollering and spilling beer. Someone helps clean up the girl on the couch. "I'm fine," she mumbles before passing out. Later, she's kissing and petting with the same or another boy. The next morning, no one will remember much of anything. Before the school year ends, someone will be pregnant and someone will be dead. Joanne Wypijowski continues, "This was my experience in the social whirl of a middle-class Catholic school in the 1970s. It was very much like Steubenville." Sidebar comment, the writer identifies the teenagers by their first initials. The full names of the two boys have been widely reported in the media, so I will use their first names here. I do not know the name of the girl. I will invent a name and call her Arlene. Back to the text. Almost nothing anyone did in Steubenville that night, August 11 to 12, 2012, almost nothing anyone did was right or responsible. The girl at the heart of the case, Arlene, drank herself to oblivion at a party stocked with a table full of liquor and beer. The hostess's brother, a high school coach, shut down the bash, but left the kids to their own devices. Arlene left with Trent. The girlfriends let her go. Arlene and others drove to someone's house. After 20 minutes, the mother shooed them away. Her son said Arlene was too wasted to stay. Trent and Malik carried Arlene out by the arms and legs. Outside, she sat down in the middle of the street to vomit. The two boys were holding her hair. No observer seems to have thought it odd that she or they had removed her shirt so it wouldn't get soiled. On the next car ride, Trent fingered Arlene and played with her breasts, while she mumbled softly, and another drunken boy made a 3-minute video. At that boy's house, Arlene threw up again and again. Malik stayed with her in the bathroom while others cleaned the rug. Soon afterwards, Arlene was lying naked on the rec room floor while Malik fingered her and Trent slapped his limp genital organ against her hip. Another boy, a former boyfriend of Arlene, took pictures and then left. Then Trent may or may not have tried to get Arlene to perform oral sex on him. Later, Arlene gave the boys the password to her phone. Then she and Trent fell asleep together on the couch. This might have been any night in teenage straight land. Later, the kids would have gone off to college and done the same on spring break. Having survived, most would eventually marry. Marriage would signal that their passage to full heterosexual maturity was complete. So much rhetoric in the so-called marriage equality debate makes it seem as if marriage were a gift heterosexuals might bestow, a magic bag of lessons on how to be proper adult lovers. Frankly, heteros have nothing to teach homos, beyond maybe how to endure childbirth. Our public zeal to arrest toddlers for stealing a kiss and to put teenagers in jail for having stupid, drunken, nasty sex shows the opposite. that heteros have something to learn from the history of gay liberation. This is not to romanticize homosexuality, but because history did not present gay people with the open choice of the jungle or the single-family house in the suburbs, gays developed an alternative culture. They developed a relational language and a set of ethics that enabled them to have at least a decent experiment, a decent anonymous encounter, a decent first time. Not necessarily a transcendent one, but not an awful one either. They developed a different sense of family. Gay kids may drink or damage themselves and others, for all the reasons anyone in this society might. But gay culture does not teach its kids that the surest route to sex is through a bottle and a lie. Straight culture teaches that. Okay, so we heard a really nice long essay by Nation columnist Joanne Wipajoski on why what happened in Steubenville is sadly the norm, and whether maybe gay people might want to think twice before deciding they want to hold the heteros up as the norm for love, romance, and committed relationships. And just to prove Wipajoski is right, just a few weeks ago in April, we have another story, pretty much the same story as Steubenville, this time from San Jose, California. And this time the girl was not 16, but 15. Her name was given as Audrey Pott, who ended up committing suicide when pictures of an encounter she doesn't even remember ended up all over the World Wide Web. You're listening to our latest show, which is on the theme Love and Death. And as you can see, we have reservations about both of them. And that's more than enough from New World Notes. And thanks for listening. You can download any of our broadcasts from our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum. Don't drink and drive. Know who your friends are. And please come back again next week. Ciao.
So long, so long. You get me waiting so long, so long. Let me serenade you with one last song. You're back where you belong. So long, so long, so long.